Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 187. Happy at Last with Dr. Richard O'Connor. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So the good news is we can change our own brains if we practice living mindfully, if we practice thinking of three good things at night, if we practice making wiser decisions. The bad news is it takes longer than we want it to. You know, it took 3 months of daily practice for the jugglers to show changes in gray matter. It's probably going to take 3 months or more for us to make sort of permanent changes in our happiness level, to make those permanent adjustments upward in our happiness thermostat. But we can do it if we just hang in there.
So says my guest, Dr. Richard O'Connor, author of Happy at Last, The Thinking Person's Guide to Finding Joy. Richard O'Connor, MSW, PhD, is the author of Happy at Last, The Thinking Person's Guide to Finding Joy. His earlier books are Undoing Depression and Undoing Perpetual Stress. For 14 years, he was executive director of the Northwest Center for Family Service and Mental Health, a private, nonprofit mental health clinic serving Litchfield County, Connecticut, overseeing the work of 20 mental health professionals and treating almost 1,000 patients per year. He's currently a practicing psychotherapist with offices in Connecticut and New York. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Richard O'Connor, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
David, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let me say at the outset that I love your book. I've been reading quite a few books lately on the topic of happiness, and I think yours is going to be a keeper.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad you feel that way.
Yeah, very much so. Now, before we get into the book, though, tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I'm a clinical social worker. I came to Connecticut about 25 years ago to be the director of a community mental health center out here, and stayed in that position for 10 years and branched out into private practice. And at the same time, I published my first book, which was Undoing Depression.
Well, let's start even further back. Where did you grow up? Where did you grow up?
And
where did you go to college? What did you major in?
I grew up in what is now the unhealthiest town in the country. I grew up in Huntington, West Virginia for the first 10 years of my life.
Uh-huh.
And we moved to Chicago, but I went to school out east here, Trinity College in Hartford. And, you know, I'll tell you, I might as well broach the subject now. In my books, I've been open about my own experience with depression.
Yes, that's one of the things that I really like about the book.
Yeah.
Something I can identify with as well myself.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my mother had committed suicide while I was in high school.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and I was foolish enough to think that it wasn't having much effect on me. But when I got to college, I didn't do well.
Not too surprising, given what was going
on.
Yeah,
well, you know, I devoted myself to social life and drinking too much.
Mm-hmm.
And but graduated and went back to Chicago.
No. What did you major in during that period, even though you were probably skipping class a lot and so on?
Oh, I majored in English, and then in my last year I switched to psychology.
Okay.
I loved literature, but in my last year decided I really couldn't go along with the way it was being taught there.
Uh-huh.
And psychology was another love. So I graduated in psychology, went back to Chicago, went to work for Encyclopedia Britannica, of all things, as a copy editor for a few years, and got very depressed. and got myself into therapy for the first time. And it was a, you know, this was, what, 1970. This was a, I was seeing a married couple as therapists. They were doing Eric Byrne stuff, you know, games
yes.
people play.
Yes.
But actually they were pretty helpful. And they really helped me see I needed to set a direction for my life. And so I decided I would be interested in doing what they were doing
yes.
and being a therapist.
Right.
So I got into the MSW program at the University of Chicago and did very well there compared to my college career. So well that they invited me to join the PhD program, which I did. I thought I might be an academic for a while, but got turned off by academic politics. And really, by that time, I'd started working in outpatient mental health clinics and really liked it. So that's what I continued to do for about 20 years, 25 years, until I just went into private practice on my own.
Okay, well, thanks for taking us on that earlier yeah. journey. I think it sets an important backdrop.
So I should say also, I think, you know, I've during that time, I've had a couple of episodes of major depression, and much of my life has been spent in sort of a state of mild depression, and wrote 3 books about depression. Finally decided it was time to advance a little beyond that. And, you know, all my books are primarily for me in the first place, so I decided to write about happiness, and I think the act of writing about it has really helped me. I hope it helps other people, too, because I found some ideas that were really really have made a difference in my life.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why the book, you know, speaks so strongly to me, is that it's so clearly uh-huh. rooted in your own quest, your own experience, and you put enough of that in there to kind of yeah. give the feeling like, oh, there's a human being on the other end of this book. which is always helpful. Now, I can't help but notice that there seems to be an explosion of people researching, talking about, and writing about happiness. As a matter of fact, I just got back from attending a 4-day conference in San Francisco on happiness and its causes. You weren't there by any chance, were you?
No, I wasn't. I wish I could have been.
But, yeah, you really would have liked it.
I wasn't on that mailing list.
Yeah, you would have liked it. And it was sponsored by a Tibetan Buddhist group, but they drew uh-huh. upon academics and just a very wide variety of perspectives. And so yeah. it was very interesting. And I've interviewed a number of people in the positive psychology movement.
Yes.
And it makes me step back and wonder if something's going on almost at an archetypal level. You know, why so much about happiness at this particular point in time? Do you have a take on that by any chance?
Well, you know, I did absorb a lot of my social worker training, so I think that there are a lot of social factors involved. Sociologists have been asking Americans the same question about how happy they are in exactly the same way for the past 50 years, just rating your happiness on a scale from 1 to 5.
Yeah.
And over the past 50 years, every year, fewer and fewer people say they are very happy. So it's really been a striking continual decline. And I think that social factors play a major role. I think that we don't feel very safe anymore. We don't trust institutions, government, religion, education, friends and neighbors. We are working harder than we ever have, and we're told that happiness comes from what we can buy, from buying the right things and wearing the right clothes. But we, you know, all of us try that and experience that it really doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then we're left sort of holding the bag and wondering, well, where do I go from here?
I guess I was wondering, I'm kind of speculating that maybe, you know, in the broad view of things, it's almost as if this happiness stuff has anticipated the hard times to come, you know, as we're going into this recession, perhaps depression. It's just interesting to me to note that there's this, been this big upsurge of work on happiness kind of just prior to that.
Yeah, I think that quite possibly there is some sort of synergistic thing happening, because I think, you know, all of us in one way or another are saying, you know, happiness comes from simple things.
Yeah,
real happiness comes from relationships and pleasure and sensual pleasure and pride and self-worth and things like that that really don't depend on outward success.
Yes, maybe we should start to drill down now, and a place to start is with your definition of happiness.
Well, my definition I took from the academic researchers, which is basically that happiness is a combination of joy, that is the immediate ability to feel good in the moment, plus satisfaction, meaning a feeling that you have, that you are okay with where you are in life right now. You've done most of the things that mm-hmm. are really important to you.
Mm-hmm.
You're satisfied with your relationships and et cetera. So joy plus satisfaction minus misery. And some misery is inevitable in life, but in my book I try to focus on unnecessary misery, the kind we do to ourselves. And by reducing unnecessary misery, we can increase our happiness.
Yes.
And then there's a fourth factor that I refer to as meaning, which the sociologists really can't research very well, but it's obviously very important. I mean, you know, a feeling of that your life makes sense, that it has a sense of purpose, that you belong to something bigger than yourself, that, you know, that there is a God or a community or something that explains what it's all about for you.
Right, right. I'm thinking in terms of traditional psychological constructs. They talk about state versus trait, and from what uh-huh. you've just said, it's clear that happiness has aspects of both, that there are state aspects, which you've characterized as joy, and trait. And one of the things about
let me say, I mean, one of my major points is that I think that all the new brain research is saying that we can change our trait happiness as well. You know, I think all of us are born with a little thermostat that sort of keeps putting us back to our normal state of on the happiness-unhappiness scale. We have a sort of an average.
Yeah, they call that the set point, right?
The set point.
Yeah.
But I think that there is increasing evidence that we can affect the set point through practicing mindfulness meditation, through practicing mindful living, through gaining greater self-control, through some of the positive psychology exercises of just paying more attention to joy.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I think something that you and I share in common is that we're both genetically gifted with a set point that maybe is a bit left of center.
On the low side.
Yeah, on the low side.
Yeah.
And it's certainly, I've been working at raising mine. It sounds like you've been working at raising yours and
yes.
with some success, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think personally, I think I've met with some success. I feel over the past year or so, I feel much more attentive to my life circumstances and just, you know, the small pleasures and the small beauties that are going on around me all the time. We just got back from a drive through the woods, and, you know, it's November and the leaves are all down and it's not especially pretty, but in the November light you get to see, you get to see things in the woods that you don't ordinarily see because the underbrush is all gone. So you can see all the stone walls that the farmers put up 200 years ago that are no longer in use. There's beauty in even in a winter day like this.
Oh, yes. I taught for 2 years at the University of New Hampshire, and I miss those New England seasonal changes. It just hearing you talk about it kind of brings it back. One of the phrases in your book that I really like that, and you started to talk about this, but maybe you can just kind of emphasize it again. You say happiness is smaller than we think.
Yeah, I think we're sort of conditioned to believe that happiness comes from achieving great things or making a whole lot of money. Marrying a trophy wife or spouse or having our children get into Harvard or, you know, all those kinds of things. But, you know, I mean, here's the odd thing is we have this belief in ourselves that I will be happy if I get what I want. But all the social psychology research, and if you really look at your own experience, you'll see this too. If you get what you want, you will only want something else very soon. You don't get to stay happy if you get what you want.
Right, right.
Staying happy comes from, one thing it comes from is by paying attention to small things, by allowing yourself to savor pleasurable events. You know, my example I use a couple of times in the book is a really good grilled cheese sandwich can make your day if you are sufficiently paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So this sort of endless wanting that we have, the positive psychologists, and you use this term in your book, they call it the hedonic treadmill.
Yes.
And of course, Buddhists talk about it. It's somewhere
right.
In the
craving.
Yeah, that kind of endless desire. That desire is the source of suffering.
Yes.
It's interesting to me that from these two very different directions, they're arriving at a similar conclusion.
Yeah. I think that we're going to find out from the brain, too. I think that there's more than a hint that it's the dopamine system involved here that's got something to do with cocaine and other drugs of abuse that turns on the dopamine circuits that make us want more and more and more and convince us that if we get what we want, we'll be happy, but it just doesn't work out that way.
Yeah. Many people think of happiness as a matter of chance or luck, but the view emerging from research is that it's more of a learnable skill. Maybe you could talk about that a bit.
Well, I think maintaining happiness is a learnable skill. I think that unless you're clinically depressed, you know, most of us can feel happy when a good thing happens, but it doesn't last, and we return to the thermostatic setting that's, you know, individual for each of us. But it is possible to sort of reset that set point through, you know, I'm sorry, I forgot where I was going with this question. Refresh my memory, please.
Yeah, we were talking about happiness as a matter of chance or luck. And that it's a learnable skill instead.
No, certainly good luck makes people happier than bad luck does. But even if you have good luck, it doesn't last. The famous study of lottery victims, lottery winners and accident victims, a year later found that both groups had sort of returned to their own individual set points of happiness. So if you were a fairly satisfied person who happened to have an accident and become disabled, you were still, a year later, you were still feeling pretty good about your life. And if you were a fairly miserable person and you won the lottery, you were just a rich, miserable person.
Yeah.
So it is something that you learn partly by paying attention, partly by being mindful. You increase satisfaction in your life by making the right decisions, making the right choices. And there are certainly ways of learning how to think and how to make decisions that are more productive than other ways are. And that's not only psychology, it's just empiricism.
Yes.
And people can learn that. It's too bad it's never taught in school, but it's not that hard to learn.
Yeah, for example, one of the examples that you give, I think, is in relation to consumerism and our sort of eternal desiring, wanting,
yeah,
is to, you point out that you can either get rich by earning a lot more money or by wanting a lot less.
Right. Yes.
And it's
and which is easier.
Yeah, which is easier. For some people, it's easier to earn a lot of money, I guess. But
it's sort of swimming upstream in America to try to be satisfied with less. But I think that the recession may force more and more people into adopting that as a strategy.
Yeah, I think that may be a bit of a silver lining in the recession.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Certainly, in my own experience, I've had a reasonably long life at this point and, mm-hmm. Gone through lots of things where I really wanted something, really coveted, having
yes.
a certain computer or a certain
yeah.
gadget or something.
Yeah.
And the satisfaction so many times has been short-lived,
yes.
There are lots of things that I've bought where I realized that, geez, it just didn't bring that much satisfaction or pleasure.
Yes.
So I've reached a point in my life where I can have that dialogue ahead of time and kind of assess, put it in a more realistic perspective. Do I really need this? Is this going to bring me a lot of happiness and satisfaction?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or a week later, will it just be sort of sitting in the corner unused?
And it's a great joy to make that kind of decision. It gives you a rosy glow inside to go shopping and decide there's nothing you need.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This whole round of Christmas thing is a little distressing in that regard because not
yes.
everybody in my family is at the same place here in terms of this realization. So there are all these expectations around giving and receiving,
yes.
et cetera.
Well, it is better to give. I think, a great deal of pleasure comes from vicariously from seeing the pleasure on other people's faces when we can give them something that's personally meaningful.
Yes.
I think that, unfortunately, too often we're tempted to give them something that is just a fancy trinket that, mm-hmm. as you say, they're going to lose interest in a couple of weeks, and that makes it all seem sort of empty.
Yes. There's a term that you use in the book. It's a Greek term that was fairly new to me. I'd heard it before, but I think this is the first place I've seen it written down, and it might be new for my listeners. It's eudaimonia, spelled E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A. Tell us about eudaimonia and where that concept comes from.
Well, that's a Greek term. It's not coming back to me immediately.
Yeah. Well, I co-authored a book, and there's a lot that I can't remember. It's like, it's out of sight, out of mind. And I'm just pulling it up in your book here. It's on page 15. I'll refresh your memory here. It says, the other theory of happiness is referred to as eudaimonia, living in accordance with one's...
Oh, eudaimonia versus hedonism, of course.
Yeah,
yeah. Sort of...
And you say it's credited to Aristotle, so it goes all the way back to the Greeks,
yes.
the kinds of insights that we've been talking about here.
Yeah, I argue later in the book that the positive psychologists are really promoting eudaimonia, the feeling that you're living up to your best self. Oprah talks about this a lot too, right, being your best self. Positive psychology likes to talk about finding your own character strengths and making the most of them.
Yes.
I wanted to set that up as sort of straw man to knock down a little bit, because it's often contrasted with hedonism, you know, the simple pursuit of pleasure. And I wanted to make the point that there's nothing wrong with hedonism either, as long as it doesn't go too far. And that hedonism has been the principle on which the Enlightenment was based on which our society was based on. It's the basis for Locke and Mill to try to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. That's enlightened hedonism. So I think that my problem with positive psychology is that it neglects simple pleasure a little bit and talks about building good character. And mm-hmm. nothing wrong with building good character. You have to do it if you want to be happy. But I think that it's also very appropriate to emphasize pleasure too. And they have a great exercise, this wonderful exercise about when you go to sleep at night, just mentally review three good things that happened during the day. You know, three things that brought a smile to your face or a sense of satisfaction, and they can be anything from, you know, your daughter gets into college, or you had a really good grilled cheese sandwich, or you smiled at somebody on the street, or had a great dinner. The finding is that if you really sort of focus your brain on those things as you go to sleep, you wake up in a better mood in the morning, and the mood seems to last during the day.
Yeah, I agree with you that is a very powerful exercise. It's actually one that I would swear my office mate at the university told me about doing that, 20 years ago or longer.
My wife told me about doing it, and she came from her Jewish mother.
Interesting.
I think it's been around.
Yeah, and my office mate, I told him about this, that, you know, this was one of the greatest gifts that he ever gave me, because it's kind of stuck with me, and I've practiced it from time to time, never in a thoroughly a disciplined way, but when I do remember to do it, you know, it's wonderful. He doesn't even ever remember telling me that. It was a new concept to him, which I...
forgot about.
He did. I know he's the one that I got it from.
Yeah.
And, you know, any time that I've thought to do it, even the most mundane day, if you take the time at the end of the day and say, okay, well, what happened today that I could be grateful for?
Yeah.
You know? No matter how mundane the day, you can always find particular little interpersonal interactions. You know, somebody smiled at me, or my kid said something nice to me.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, of course, that's what people with depression have the most trouble with, is because their minds seem to be so dominated by negative thoughts and all the things that went wrong and all the things that they did wrong and all the things that they feel guilty about. And they really have to learn this as a skill to be practiced day after day. But they can learn. It really just takes repetition.
Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, you've gone through depression. That's been a big issue in your life. You've written two books on it. And so I'm wondering how this positive psychology, happiness work that you have uncovered, how that impacts your clinical practice.
Mm. Yeah, I think it has impacted it greatly. One thing I realized is that most of my depressed patients set their goals too low. When they come in, they desire to get back to normal, because they're feeling out of control with their lives. They're feeling like something has happened that they don't understand, and they have to get back to normal. But normal for them is really pretty low standard. They don't know what it is to feel good. They don't know what it is to feel happy. So I think it. I am now spending more time with people, encouraging them to go on further beyond just simply not feeling symptomatic anymore, but feeling good about themselves and feeling like they're making something of their lives and feeling some pleasure.
How do you do that? How do you approach that?
Well, you know, timing is everything. You can't, someone who's sitting in your office in great distress week after week, year after year, you can't really say to them, you know, you'd probably feel a lot better if you just got up and went for a walk right now. But you have to plant that seed.
Yeah.
So that they will start thinking about it. So, you know, I get pretty directive in my therapy, and I really encourage people to practice some of the exercises in my books, to exercise as much as possible, because it really has been shown to be as effective as an antidepressant. You know, to get out and socialize, to set goals for themselves and try to achieve those goals. I think Tal Ben-Shahar, who is another happiness writer,
yes,
makes this great point that he says, first of all, depression can be defined as the absence of goals. He also says that even if we don't achieve our goals, they've done something for us. They've focused our lives. They've given us a purpose for a while, and they moved us off the dime. They've taken us somewhere different from where we started. And we are generally so adaptable that even if we don't quite achieve what we thought we wanted, we'll have gotten to someplace better, and we may be very satisfied with that.
Yes, yes, and it's sort of that old wisdom that it's the process. The process is more important than the goal, or the process,
yes,
is more important than arriving.
Right.
There's been
journey, not the arrival, yeah, matters.
Yeah. And, you know, you've mentioned mindfulness several times in our discussion, mm-hmm, and it's really a centerpiece of your book is mindfulness, mm-hmm, meditation as one of at least three major strategies that you, mm-hmm, talk about. There's been a real explosion of interest in that approach. Do you consider yourself a Buddhist?
No, and I don't practice meditation nearly as much as I want to.
Mm-hmm.
But I have become more mindful just by writing and thinking and talking with my patients about the process. And I hope one of my goals right now, I'm in the middle of doing a revision of Undoing Depression. But as soon as that's done, I want to get back to practicing mindfulness meditation,
mm-hmm,
every day.
Yeah.
One of the things that I have observed whenever I try to meditate is how automatically I start judging things, and I think this is true for a great many people. You quickly start judging the meditation experience.
Yes.
Your mind gets filled with thoughts of, I'm not doing this right, this is uncomfortable, I'm not going to last a half an hour, what do I have to do as soon as this is done?
I've been there. I know what you're talking,
yeah,
about.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah, and I think that's all the judging mind at work. And
yes,
I think once you begin to be aware that there's this voice inside of you that's constantly evaluating your experience negatively, you can begin to distance yourself from it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I likened it to the Three Stooges in the book. I called it the inner Mo, just as a way of poking fun at it. Because, you know, all this really negative, harsh, critical viewpoint of ourselves cannot be possibly be accurate. It's a mental habit. It's just a habit.
Yes.
And we can unlearn it.
That's right. There are two kinds of mindfulness. One is the formal sitting discipline of meditation, and then, mm-hmm, the other is, just as you point out, during the course of the day, we can become more aware of those voices in our head, the ones,
yes,
that say negative things to us, the,
yes,
ways in which we judge ourselves or judge other people.
Right. It's the same thing as what cognitive behavioral therapy has been teaching for years, except, you know, in my opinion, you don't have to counter those negative thoughts with positive counter arguments. I think you just have to learn to distance yourself from them and to see them as just a voice in your brain that's, you know, maybe, you know, your critical father or a schoolyard bully or, you know, something that you've created out of scraps of this person and that person, and realize that, you know, nobody is as harsh as you or on you as you are yourself.
Yeah. One of the things that, not one of the things, but sort of a thread in the book, you talk about sources of unhappiness, and there are psychological sources, as you say, maybe a bully when you were a kid. You kind of touch on the sort of some of the Freudian ideas, and that due to trauma or defense mechanisms that we've developed, that these can be a source of unhappiness.
Yeah.
And then you point a finger at the way our society is structured as also a major source of unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
You call it contemporary insanity.
Yeah.
Do you talk a little bit about contemporary insanity? You've touched on it a little bit, but say a little bit more.
I don't think most people realize that this is all pre-current economic crisis, but as of January last year, for instance, we were working 25% more hours than we were working 25 years ago, and our earning power had stayed stagnant.
Yeah.
We were running harder than ever just to stay in one place. We were working harder than any country in the world, including the Japanese, who, remember, we used to make fun of the poor salarymen who were exploited by their employers. And now it turns out we're working harder than they are.
Now they are us.
Right, right. We are them.
Yes.
And so, and now both parents in a family are working, and there's no time for the children. You know, I mean, I certainly was behind the feminist revolution, but somehow we didn't take into account that what it would mean to have both parents out of the house and the kids having no structure except for, you know, these pitiful after school programs that they've got. So kids are growing up unparented. We're working harder than ever. We are guided. We're living our lives mindlessly, you know, guided by our to-do lists, guided by what's next, the next chore we have to tick off our list, and we can go on for 20 or 30 years that way and never wake up and see what life is like around us. And that's a shame. I think the fact is most people don't go on that way. They can't, because they have some sort of crisis. They have some sort of stress-related meltdown. And they, you know, go through. It may manifest itself as physical disease or anxiety or depression or drug abuse or impulsive decisions like, you know, a sudden divorce or telling the boss off and getting yourself fired. I think these are all different kinds of reactions to cumulative stress. So it is a culture of insanity. It's not what we were designed for.
Yeah.
You know, we, up until 300 years ago, society hadn't changed much for 30,000 years. 300 years ago, people still lived in small villages, didn't have clocks, knew everybody they were ever going to come in contact with, and worked only a few hours a day, and worked in a variety of things throughout the year. Nobody was expected to go to work from 9 to 5 every day in artificial light and do the same repetitive task all the time. That's something very new in the world, and it's very difficult for us to adjust to, and I think it's the cause of much suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, as we wrap up here.
Okay.
Let's end on a more positive, happier note if we can. are there any ideas that you'd like to leave our audience with?
Well, I think that's the really good news about the new brain science, is that we can change our brains.
Yeah.
You know, we can, through focused attention and practice. Unfortunately, we can't seem to change our brains very much just by thinking about it, but by practicing and learning new skills. And in the book, I keep using this example of the college students who were taught to juggle, and the researchers who could actually see visible growth in gray matter in their brains after 3 months of daily juggling practice. So the good news is we can change our own brains if we practice living mindfully, if we practice thinking of three good things at night, if we practice making wiser decisions. The bad news is it takes longer than we want it to. You know, it took 3 months of daily practice for the jugglers to show changes in gray matter. It's probably going to take 3 months or more for us to make sort of permanent changes in our happiness level, to make those permanent adjustments upward in our happiness thermostat. But we can do it if we just hang in there, if we just remind ourselves that every day of practice means a little bit of change.
Well, that is a great reminder. I've enjoyed speaking with you, Richard.
So have I. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Dr. Richard O'Connor, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Richard O'Connor. If depression is an issue for you or someone you know, you might want to look at his two earlier books. Once again, those are Undoing Depression and Undoing Perpetual Stress. I haven't read them, but if his current book on happiness is any indication, I would think they'd be excellent. As you know, Shrink Wrap Radio has evolved in a direction where a great many of the people I interview are authors. Consequently, I'm getting a lot of books, and between you and me, I don't keep most of them. I'm trying to simplify my life, and not accumulating a whole house full of books is part of that effort, albeit not terribly successfully. And as you heard me observe, there seems to be a huge upsurge of happiness books. I've been hanging on to the happiness books with the idea that I might teach a course on positive psychology at some point. In fact, I've proposed such a course for the Lifelong Learning Institute at Sonoma State University a couple of times. For some reason that I don't understand, they haven't risen to the bait yet. I'm sure such a course would be very popular among the seniors who enroll in lifelong learning. A few years ago, I taught a dreams course through that program that was very well received. At any rate, of all the books I've read on positive psychology and the pursuit of happiness, two stand out as real keepers, ones that I would probably assign to my students and draw upon heavily for my lectures. The first would be The Happiness Hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt, whom I interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 142. The other would be this one, Richard O'Connor's book, Happy at Last, The Thinking Person's Guide to Finding Joy. I think the thing that really appeals to me about Richard's book is the emphasis on the thinking person. In the writing, it's clear that he is a thinking person and that it's directed to the thoughtful reader. Rather than a mindless regurgitation of the literature, he shares his own struggle and works through key aspects of the happiness literature in a way that is both thoughtful and practical. I know some of you go out and buy books based on what you hear here. I know that because of the emails that you've sent me. Let me hasten to say I have no financial interest in your doing so. I don't have a bookstore sponsor, more's the pity. But Richard's book definitely has my buy recommendation.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
You might be interested to know that we've been invited to join the PodMed.com network, a collection of medically related podcasts. Shrink Wrap Radio can be found there as well as at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, speaking of other networks, you might also be interested in my latest interview on wisecounselpodcast.com. There you'll find my interview with Dr. Morteza Kalaghi on treating emotional trauma and addiction. Dr. Kalaghi runs a couple of addiction treatment centers, one of which is in Malibu. So I'm guessing that that might be one of the places where stars go when they run into these kinds of problems. Dr. Kalaghi comes from a psychoanalytic perspective, but integrates other perspectives as well in these addiction treatment centers. He also reports that he's a consultant to the well-known U.S. TV shrink, Dr. Phil. Hey, there's a good idea. Maybe I should call myself Dr. Dave. It worked for him. Maybe it'll work for me. We're in the midst of the holiday season, and if you get this in time, I want to wish you all a most meaningful holiday, whether it be Hanukkah, Christmas, Festivus, or whatever you might be celebrating, and to thank you all for listening to another year of Shrink Wrap Radio. We're nearing the end of our fourth year of this podcast. That's really hard for me to believe. Whew. This is show number 187, almost 200. It's been a lot of work on my part, but I've learned a lot and received a lot of loving energy and support from you. As you know, we're now seeking some financial support through your donations. November got off to a great start, but December has been rather chilly so far with only a single donation, for which I'm most grateful. You know who you are. So despite the recession and the fact that you may have just spent a lot of money on presents for family and friends, please consider making a donation to support Shrink Wrap Radio if you haven't already done so. Look for the big green donate button on our website. You're probably away from your computer right now, off jogging or riding in your car or on a train or working out at the gym or who knows what. Well, cross your toes and keep them crossed to remind you to follow through on those good intentions. Ho, ho, ho.
This is Heather Gout from the Naked Soul Podcast, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Heather, thanks for that lovely transition. And now you all know who is the owner of that lovely voice that you heard in brief segments in my last two podcasts. I'm surprised no one wrote to ask. In fact, we have only two brief emails to catch up on. The first one is from longtime listener and one-time guest, Anna of the Anna is a Man blog, who writes, "Hi, David. Since the last time we spoke, I was getting into your interview with Nova Spivak, and I was interrupted so many times it took me until this morning to finally finish and write a review." And then he gives a link to his blog, which is at Anna is a Man, or Anna is a Man, spelled A-N-N-E-I-S-A-M-A-N, .blogspot.com. You can find his review there. He says, "I was very excited about the thoughts that popped up during the interview, but in the end, I was even more excited about the donation model you've taken on with the show. How is this working? In any case, since I've written twice before in the last days about the way in which podcasts try to generate some money, I've taken this aspect of the show, number 180, to highlight in my review. Anna." And indeed, he talks both about the interview with Nova Spivak, and it goes into looking at some of the different models that other podcasters are using, many of whom are putting their content behind a password-protected barrier, and people have to pay to get it. And I really didn't want to go that route, And so that's why I'm trying out the donation model. And Anna, I know you haven't had time to listen to every episode because you review so many podcasts. So just to give you a quick recap, I'm in my second month of donations. And if you're hearing this, then you'll gather that November went well and December not so well so far. And so we'll see. I'm going to keep giving it a try for a while. And if it doesn't pick up or isn't consistent, then I'll probably go to a mixed model of donations along with some little advertising spots, hopefully for products that I really feel good about. The other email comes from Susan, one of our champion transcribers, who needed to withdraw from that activity due to some health challenges she's been facing. I had dropped her a brief note asking how she was doing, and she wrote back, "Hi, David, so nice to hear from you. I hope you and your family are having a lovely, peaceful Christmas season, and that you'll have a very happy and healthy 2009. Thanks so much for writing. I am doing a little better, thanks, though we'll still be glad to see some of this fatigue go. It's just not convenient this time of year. I don't need it. I hear sleet against the window right now. We're in for some icy roads tonight. But never fear, House is on. It's the only TV show to which I've become thoroughly addicted. I meant to write you about your wonderful interview of Dr. Morteza Kalegi on Wise Counsel, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I don't believe I've ever heard such a sensitive and knowledgeable therapist who specializes in addiction before, and can only imagine how much his clients benefit from interacting with him. It's so sad that much of the devotion and empathy he brings to his profession was born of his brother's tragedy. He truly understands addiction from the inside out. Thank you for your, as always, sensitive interview. Here's to happy holidays and a great 2009. I can't wait for the inauguration, though I'm relieved I don't have to commute to D.C. anymore. It'll be nightmarish in town that week. Stay well, and thanks again for writing. All the bestest, Susan." And Susan, all the bestest to you as well. And so I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to me, and hey, they've shrunk to nothing. So send them to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Leave comments on the site. Send me some voice transitions or voicemails. You can send them on Skype. You can use my Chingo, or leave a phone message at 206-337-0622. Or you can send them as MP3 attachments in an email. Thanks again to Dr. Richard O'Connor for his thoughts on the thinking person's approach to joy. Next week's guest will be Gary Small, MD, of UCLA, who's written the book iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. As you know, that's been one of my pet topics. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.